Thank you. orchestra and piano happily in harmony again, their arguments resolved, their differences laid aside. Mitsuko Uchida was the soloist in that performance of Beethoven's fourth piano concerto, and the cadenzas, as she told us, were Beethoven's. Enormous applause right the way through this packed Albert Hall for Uchida. Marius Janssens conduct the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra. It's perfectly clear watching Janssens and Uchida on stage that they work together extraordinarily carefully, and indeed Uchida told us this morning how much she likes working with him and indeed with the Bavarian Orchestra. And there was a wonderful moment at the end of that long, mighty first movement in which Janssens just turned to Uchida and just held out his left hand, and she, with a half-clenched fist, reached out back to him and said, "Yes, we've done it, we've got to the end." But it was all done with such extraordinary delicacy. This year's Proms, of course, are featuring piano concertos, with over 20 of them altogether, from Mozart to Lutoslawski, by Beethoven, Brahms and Ravel. And you can hear every one of these concertos again for 30 days after its appearance here at the Proms. You simply go to the Proms website and look for the Listen and Watch tab at the top of the page, and press it. Mitsuko Uchida returning to the stage. Marius Janssens bringing the orchestra to their feet. Cheering, as you can hear, throughout the hall. Warmth and enthusiasm for that extraordinarily perceptive, delicate performance of Beethoven's fourth piano concerto. Beethoven, but also Schubert and Mozart, very much the repertoire that Uchida has made her own. Most recently, she has, of course, also been directing from the keyboard. She's directed Mozart for the Mahler Chamber Orchestra and two American orchestras too, Chicago and the Cleveland Symphony Orchestras, both again directing from the keyboard. Clearly a change in step in her career, if not in direction. Feet are pounding out as they do at the Albert Hall. Now she thinks they can hear it right the way through the whole of South Kensington too. It's such a thunderous sound, and that suggests to me that we're not going to get away without an encore, or rather I should say Uchida, and she's literally running back on the stage, and indeed I think we are going to get an encore. Thank you. after Beethoven? Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach's Sarabande from the G major French suite, played by Mitsuko Uchida as an encore. And members of the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra applauding her. Strings tapping their bows, applause from the woodwind and the timpani at the back. I asked Uchida why we'd had to wait so long for her to return for proms, and she simply shrugged her shoulders and said, it's all a question of dates. And she does lead an extraordinarily busy life. But she'll be going on from here to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Festival with indeed this orchestra. She returns the stage now, applauded by the orchestra and the full house here, shaking hands, indeed hugging tonight's leader. She goes to Edinburgh with the orchestra, and then she has a residency, I think, at the Lucerne Festival, the summer festival. And she's always in enormous demand, both as a soloist with orchestras and indeed as a soloist on her own. You perhaps can sense the extraordinary warmth that she seems to evoke in audiences, particularly here in the Albert Hall. The promenade is wreathed in smiles, a kind of sort of benevolent look encompassing them all collectively. Well, in the second part of tonight's prom here, live on Radio 3, the home of the proms, there's just a single work. It's Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. But first, we have an interval, and this evening's 20 minutes. Earlier this evening, across the road from the Royal Albert Hall at the Royal College of Music, Matthew Sweet and his guests discussed the poetry of Sylvia Plath for a Proms Plus audience.
Sylvia Plath wrote poetry and fiction in a voice so distinctive that it now seems to constitute a mode of its own. We don't talk as much about the Plathian as we do about the Dickensian or the Byronic, but when you read her work, her collections The Colossus and Ariel, for instance, or her only novel, The Bell Jar, you're hearing something that you hear nowhere else. She's also part of that small band of artists whose name has travelled beyond the literary, like Stendhal and Liszt. She's given her name to a medical term, the Sylvia Plath effect. Mm-hmm. Plath liked sunbathing, she liked basketball, she liked sweet sherry, she liked Ouija boards. Mm-hmm. She was also a Beethoven fan. And as we'll hear tonight, the music of Beethoven is legible in her writing, in the Bell Jar perhaps, particularly. Tonight, we're going to breathe the atmosphere of her work with two who know it well, the poet Lavinia Greenlaw and the literary historian Sally Bailey. Let's start with The Bell Jar. It's a rite of passage for many readers, isn't it, Lavinia? How did you discover it?
I discovered it like any other sort of overheated teenage girl and read it avidly and didn't understand its influence on me for a very long time.
Do people read it at the wrong moment then, do you think, or is that really the right moment to read it?
I think it's the right moment to read it because if you are that kind of person looking for something to meet your own intensity, it's exactly the right thing to read. But I think Plath altogether is a pretty dangerous and terrible influence.
In what way?
Well, she inspires us to write, and then we think we can write like her without having her extraordinary technical expertise and her control and her precision. I mean, you can't write madly about madness. You have to write very precisely about it in order for it to convey itself clearly. And that's exactly what she does. And The Bell Jar, while it's somebody breaking down, is full of very, very detailed, fissured images of just tracking very precisely a sensation and the movement of sensation or the loss of sense.
Sally Bailey, how did you encounter this book? Were you a teenager when you read it as well?
I was 17. I was at my sixth form college, and I remember a very flamboyant Italian girl rushing into our classroom and saying, "The Bell Jar, The Bell Jar, I've just finished The Bell Jar." And she was one of those girls who everyone paid attention to. So I quietly snuck off to the Brighton Public Library to find out about this Sylvia Plath and The Bell Jar. I was quite a serious 17-year-old, so I'm not sure if I was in the right vein to read The Bell Jar. I think The Bell Jar's extraordinarily witty, funny, exuberant, naughty, at times sadistic, It shifts all over the place. It's like being on a fairground ride.
OK, well, let's begin the ride, shall we? The actor Buffy Davis, I'm very pleased to say, is with us, and she's going to read the opening of The Bell Jar. Buffy.
It was a queer, sultry summer. The summer they electrocuted the Rosenbergs, and I didn't know what I was doing in New York. I'm stupid about executions. The idea of being electrocuted makes me sick, and that's all there was to read about in the papers. Goggle-eyed headlines staring up at me on every street corner, and at the fusty, peanut-smelling mouth of every subway. It had nothing to do with me, but I couldn't help wondering what it would be like being burned alive all along your nerves. I thought it must be the worst thing in the world.
Thanks very much, Buffy. Lavinia, 50 years since that was first published. Do you think it retains its immediacy, its freshness?
I think it does. I mean, you will find an awful lot of novels with similar shock openings. And nowadays, if I opened a novel and it began like that, I'd shut it fast because it sounds so lurid. But it's so clever the way that it's immediately she's thinking about boys and clothes and all the ordinary things and these leaking of disturbance into it. It's a very compelling balance.
There seems to be something strangely unchanged about elements of this world that she's documenting too, Sally, particularly the pressures upon her central character are not ones that feel too archival, are they?
No, not at all. I think if you had to recommend this to a 16, 17, 18-year-old girl, the same preoccupations with self, how do I look? Am I wearing the right lipstick? Have I got the right dress on? Is anyone going to take me seriously as a young woman? How do I walk about the place? How do I find my way in and out of places? You know, those kinds of concerns, that self-consciousness of young women.
I mean, that's why it's much easier when you're older to see the humour in it, because when you're reading it at 17, you're thinking, exactly, you know, I would spend all night worrying about the dresses in my cupboard or how to part my hair. But now we look at it and we laugh.
And what's going on in this opening moment, then? This is something about losing control, isn't it? There's something already beginning to show here, isn't it?
Her thought processes are losing control. So, like everyone else in New York, she will be walking past headlines saying the Rosenbergs are about to be executed. But the image that forms in her head is the memory of the one time she's seen a dead body. Mm. And there's this extraordinary image of how the head of that drowned man, she feels as if she's carrying it around on the string, like a balloon, a brown balloon that stinks of vinegar. Mm. So you've got in that the actual memory, a very shocking physical memory of this body, and what her imagination is doing with it, and the feeling that she's carrying it around on a string so she cannot escape the horrors. Mm. So everything is detonating for her.
So where's it leading us, Sally?
I think everything's a specimen in Plath's world, you know? The culture that surrounds her is a specimen. The Rosenbergs are a specimen. Eisenhower is a specimen. She desiccates and she undoes everything. She pulls everything apart in a very forensic way. But I think this is a woman writer with a great deal of aplomb, trying to imitate both a teenager and an older woman. And I think to go back to the teenage Plath, if you like, teenagers are very cruel. They do dissect people. Everyone is a specimen under their gaze. And I think she does that brilliantly. I love the way she uses the word stupid. She's not afraid to use the word stupid. I'm stupid about executions.
Sally, you've already mentioned the humour in the book. And it struck me, you know, having read it as well as a teenager and going back to it just in the last few days, what a very funny book it is. I want to show that with a moment from the novel when the heroine, Esther Greenwood, and a girlfriend, Betsy, begin to feel the poisonous effects of eating a dodgy crab meat and avocado salad. Buffy.
Betsy looked a fright. The bloom was gone from her cheeks, and her drained face floated in front of me, green and sweating. We fell into one of those yellow checkered cabs that are always waiting at the curb when you are trying to decide whether or not you want a taxi. And by the time we reached the hotel, I had puked once, and Betsy had puked twice. The cab driver took the corners with such momentum that we were thrown together, first on one side of the back seat and then on the other. Each time one of us felt sick, she would lean over quietly as if she had dropped something and was picking it up off the floor. And the other one would hum a little and pretend to be looking out the window. The cab driver seemed to know what we were doing, even so. "Hey!" he protested, driving through a light that had just turned red. "You can't do that in my cab! You better get out and do it in the street!"
Thanks, Buffy.
Sally, why do people never say that witty writer, Sylvia Plath, that master of comic observation, Sylvia Plath?
I think there's a compulsion to narrate her life through death, and it's a traumatic loop that we seem to go through every time we mention the name Sylvia Plath, and we can't get off that traumatic loop or that record skipping. I find it particularly frustrating. I'm much more interested in the extraordinary richness of register that she holds, just in the passage that you just read, Buffy, the way we slide between voices so brilliantly. She's a ventriloquist. She's a puppet master.
And she's not actually setting out to be funny. She's setting out to be truthful.
Is there a sort of, I mean, if we can pursue a sort of musical allegory, is there some kind of counterpoint going on here between the comic and the gruesome?
Yes, I think there is. And I think it comes very quickly upon you. You mentioned Beethoven in your introduction. And about the same time that she was writing The Bell Jar, she and Ted Hughes were listening on their gramophone record to Beethoven, particularly the Grosse Fuge, which is that extraordinary counterpoint composition which lurches very dramatically and emotionally from being very quiet to being very loud and kind of cartoonish, if you like. When Buffy was performing just now, I was seeing an American cartoon, actually, with voices.
Cartoonishness is not something that we associate with her poetry, though, is it, Lavinia? Are her prose and her poetry performed in different voices?
No, but I think that this feeling of cartoonishness comes from the fact that poets, like all artists, find it harder than they think to set aside their own dignity. Mm. And Plath will do that, and she will go up high or down low to reach the exact image. That's the mark of a great artist who doesn't sort of get stopped by saying, actually, this isn't very elegant. And she'll go right into the pathetic, but do so in a way that actually makes it far more serious, not without diffusing anything.
Was she writing poetry and prose simultaneously?
Yes, she was, yes. So she's drafting The Bell Jar at exactly the same time that she's practicing her great voice masterpiece, Elm. So, and her poem, Elm, which is an extraordinary odyssey through the process of practicing and rehearsing, like music, like composition, line after line after line. I think we're going to hear that in a moment.
We are.
And on the other side of these manuscript drafts is The Bell Jar. And it feels like an extraordinary juxtaposition. But one of the things I think that holds them together is the experimental quality of her voice.
Buffy, can we hear Elm, please?
"I know the bottom," she says. "I know it with my great tap root. It is what you fear. I do not fear it. I have been there. Is it the sea you hear in me, its dissatisfactions, or the voice of nothing that was your madness? Love is a shadow, how you lie and cry after it. Listen. These are its hoofs. It has gone off like a horse. All night I shall gallop thus, impetuously, till your head is a stone, your pillow a little turf, echoing, echoing. Or shall I bring you the sound of poisons? This is rain now, this big hush. And this is the fruit of it, tin white, like arsenic. I have suffered the atrocity of sunsets. Scorched to the root, my red filaments burn and stand, a hand of wires. Now I break up in pieces that fly about like clubs. A wind of such violence will tolerate no bystanding. I must shriek. The moon also is merciless. She would drag me cruelly, being barren. Her radiance scathes me. Or perhaps I have caught her. I let her go. I let her go, diminished and flat, as after radical surgery. How your bad dreams possess and endow me. I am inhabited by a cry. Nightly it flaps out, looking with its hooks for something to love. I am terrified by this dark thing that sleeps in me. All day I feel its soft, feathery turnings, its malignity. Clouds pass and disperse. Are those the faces of love, those pale irretrievables? Is it for such I agitate my heart? I am incapable of more knowledge. What is this? This face so murderous in its strangle of branches, its snaky acid's kiss. It petrifies the will. These are the isolate, slow faults that kill. That kill. That kill.
Thank you very much, Buffy. Lavinia, there is something sort of inescapable about this poem, isn't it? We are addressed so directly in such a seemingly confessional way.
Yes, and it's, for me, an oddly incoherent poem. It's one in which, as Sally says, Plath is trying out different voices, and you have lines and phrases which are very clinical, like, you know, clinical, the isolate, slow faults, the pale irretrievables, very cool, clinical language. And then a line which, for me, comes from a bad pop song. I have suffered the atrocity of sunsets.
So are we wrong, then, to think of all of this poetry as absolutely coherent, like totally attached to this very sort of formed personality? Should we think of these as more broken objects,
absolutely,
as if we were reading T.S. Eliot, perhaps?
No, absolutely. The fragment, absolutely. The idea of the fragment is running all the way through this poem. I mean, she encourages us to think of the drama of the fragment. It's almost as if we are inside the voice itself. The voice is a kind of sound chamber, and the tree is the sound chamber, and she's chucking out sound bites. She's practicing sound bites. She's practicing hearing herself shriek out loud.
Lavinia, you've also chosen a poem for us, one from Ariel, Sheep in Fog. Why did you pick this one?
It's my favourite Plath poem. I think it's an extraordinary, it's short, it's clear, and an extraordinary evocation of this ambivalence she has about dissolution, disappearance. This poem is so poised as to give us an utter sense of the joy and release and desire for that release, as well as the sort of horror of being in a truly empty space.
Shall we hear it, Buffy? Sheep in Fog.
The hills step off into whiteness. People or stars regard me sadly. I disappoint them. The train leaves a line of breath. Oh, slow horse, the color of rust. Hooves, darless bells. All morning, the morning has been blackening, a flower left out. My bones hold a stillness. The far fields melt my heart. They threaten to let me through to a heaven starless and fatherless, a dark water.
Thank you, Buffy. Lavinia, there's a sort of elusive quality to the language in this poem, isn't there, which befits something that's defined around this image of the sheep somewhere out there in the atmosphere of this world. But where are we going at the end here? Because we seem to be offered a sort of clarity, don't we?
Well, it's either clarity or complete absence of anything. I mean, when Sylvia Plath read this poem on the radio, she said, "This poem is called Sheep in Fog. It's about some sheep in fog." And I think she was deliberately grounding us so that we didn't sort of disappear off into it. But I think her instinct was to remind us that this is about a very ordinary but at times extreme response we have when suddenly we can't make sense. We can't make sense of what we're looking at. We can't make sense of ourselves. We can't find the language. We've lost the language. We've lost tension and coordinates. And people are drawn very much to that last image, starless and fatherless, a dark water. But you have to look at what comes just before that, where she says, "They threaten to let me through to a heaven." So you've got threaten and heaven, almost rhyming, but really opposing each other. Is this a place she wants to go, or is it a place that she is being taken?
I began by asking you both about your first encounters with the bell jar. What does Plath's poetry do for us now? We sort of understand it in its historical context, perhaps. How does it speak to us now, Sally?
Well, I think hearing it again today here, I'm reminded again of that line in Elm about the bystander. And it's this idea of a voice that stands completely alone. It's utterly, utterly inimitable.
And what would life be like without her, Lavinia? I mean, how has she shaped your sensibility?
Well, I think we have many gifted and expert writers, but this combination of gift and expertise with a kind of radical drive to really push as hard as you can to get at the exact edge of language is so rare, and she still feels far more shocking, disturbing, and ambitious than many people writing now.
And that's all we have time for, I'm afraid. I'm off now to treat our guests to some crab and avocado salad. But before that happens, will you join me in thanking Sally Bailey, Lavinia Greenlaw, and Buffy Davis?
Matthew Sweet and his guests were discussing the work of the poet and novelist Sylvia Plath, who died 50 years ago this year. The producer was Gareth Croyle. And the Proms Plus Festival takes place at the Royal College of Music just about